I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
If you listen to this podcast, you clearly appreciate quality. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson is a multifaceted guitar shop offering guitar instruction, new and used guitars and amplifiers, and all accessories. We offer guitar repair of the highest quality. Instead of experiencing the total hassle of a big box store or a snarky boutique, take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson and experience what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We love guitars.
And welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works and S&R Remodeling. Joining us now, Associate Editor of the Capital Times, John Nichols. John just got back from Germany. Were people all aflutter over tariffs in Germany? Were they throwing rotten eggs at you, John?
No. You know, the weird thing about the Germans is they kind of mastered the trade thing a long time ago. And they're really looking at the whole world in a pretty smart way. They don't just do trade and hope that good things happen. They have an industrial policy, right? So their trade policy extends from serious thinking about what industries they want, how to employ people in those industries, how they evolve. And so it's kind of thought out. It's not like a seat of the pants thing with Donald Trump. And they were very aware of what was going on, but they were also very aware of some of the realities of where steel's coming from now in China and places like that. And unfortunately, there's a little thing that Americans should be conscious of. A lot of times people in Europe kind of let the president of the United States do something that's maybe a little out there on the theory that that will, you know, that a lot of the flack will hit the U.S. and they have some potential then to slide in and get ahead on something.
Well,
you know, get the picture, right?
Right. No. You know, it's funny. I don't know. For a while back, I heard a piece on NPR on Germans industrial policy and how they, you know, how they really foster an educational system that gets people ready for high-tech manufacturing. So then it's this wonderful piece, and it's very insightful, and it's very uplifting, and it's a story of this woman inheriting or basically taking over her father's business and feeling like she has an obligation to the country to keep manufacturing. And then they bring on this professor after they get done with this wonderful, edifying piece. And he's like, but you know, really, that's not a very good strategy because everything's going to get automated. I'm like, oh, God. which, of course, you've also written about.
I've written a lot about it. But you know one of the interesting things about it? This is the truth. In working on our book, we talked to a lot of Germans, including some people, both directly and then friends of ours who basically were in even bigger circles and were able to talk to very high up folks. And we kind of put this question to folks. And what we were powerfully struck by is that there were German CEOs who said, we have the capacity to automate our plants right now, but we don't know what the people would do. And so because...
I know what they do in France.
Right. Yeah. But because of the social structures in Germany, including and the union structures, which include having unions on the boards of companies, there's a question. There's a, you know, they're actually trying to figure out what it will mean and what comes next. And to give you an example, IG Metall, their big one of their big unions, was recently involved in renegotiating all sorts of work structures with the companies in some consciousness of this automation thing to lower the number of hours a week that people work, i.e. you would still have a good job and good pay, but you wouldn't work as much because there will be less need for workers in some settings. And so you understand what I'm saying is it's the thing you and I come back to again and again, Sly. In other countries, they actually plan. Like they think about how to make it work.
Well, now have they had it?
We don't.
Now have they had a chance to hear this? Are you ready now? Because
ready.
Someone has spoken on this, and this is definitive, and I'm hoping this makes its way around the world.
Now, a WISC-TV editorial with editorial director Neil Hyman.
As we have seen all too often, it is not easy for Speaker of the House Paul Ryan and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker to say no to President Trump, or more often say anything at all. So we're impressed and pleased that both have rejected the president's call for new tariffs on imported aluminum and steel and his willingness to engage in a trade war. We're persuaded by a great many nonpartisan economists who make the argument that tariffs could do real harm to the U.S. economy and that trade wars are not as easy to win as the president claims. But we're especially worried about the impact such recklessness would have on Wisconsin's trade relationships with countries like Canada and Mexico and free trade deals we support. Walker and Ryan and Democratic Congressman Ron Kind support them as well, and we thank them for that. The rest of the state's delegation should reject Trump's tariffs as well.
Has Neil maybe wandered outside the confines of Channel 3 Studios on Raymond Road? Has he paid any attention to what's been going on in Wisconsin since, and I do remember him doing the editorial being pro-NAFTA 25 years ago. Has he paid any attention?
You have a long memory. I got to say that for you.
Oh, really. I remember where everyone was on that issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have Prussian Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You remember who you hate.
Uh-huh. But it's hard to hate. It's hard to hate Neil Hyman.
No, I don't hate Neil. I mean, I like Neil quite a bit. I've known him for a very long time. It's not none of that. I mean, when I say you to hate him,
it's true. I've ruthlessly made fun of him over the years, but I don't hate him.
I think that Neil and, frankly, the editors of the Wisconsin State Journal and the Journal Sentinel and about 99 9/10 of media outlets that do editorials in the United States take a pro free trade stance.
And, of course, that isn't really a policy. It's a slogan for corporate handshakes.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing that people don't understand about trade policy is it isn't about countries. It's about corporations. And countries where the corporations have the dominant role, where they pretty much guide policy, are going to be very in favor of so-called free trade. Countries where the corporations don't have the dominant role, where there actually is some concern about society, right? You know, what workers will do, how you protect the environment, what communities can do, you know, the overall development of a humane and functioning society are much more oriented toward planning their economy and toward managing trade in a way that sends products out, brings products in, but does try to maintain, you know, some sort of societal balance. In the United States, tragically, for the last 30 years, we have had leaders in both parties and really pretty much across the upper levels of our media landscape who I genuinely think a lot of them just don't get that. They don't understand that dynamic. And so as a result, they kind of defer to theoretical economists, people who say, you know, on balance, it'd be great if everybody traded and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they don't look at the realities on the ground. And this is one of the things that has separated media and political elites from the great mass of America.
Well,
and why you end up with results that shock the commentators.
Here is Joe Scarborough with one of your heroes, Richard Haass from the Council on Foreign Affairs.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is talking about recreating a manufacturing base that owes more to like 1957 in the Great Lakes region than what China's doing. It's really frightening.
You're exactly right. We're about a century different from China. They're looking ahead. We're looking back. The president asked the other day, what's a country that doesn't produce steel? Well, that might be a country that's leader in AI or in alternative energy or in robotics, that's training its workers, not for the jobs that will never come back, but is training the workers so they're able to take the jobs that will come into existence. So China's looking forward, we're looking backwards, and guess who's going to dominate the 21st century if this continues?
Does Richard Haass understand it's China using backwards technology to produce way too much steel, you know, sponsored by the government to drive our more high-tech, more pro-environmentally friendly steel factories out of business? Does he not understand that?
I don't know what Richard Haass understands. However, I would really recommend that somebody lend him some books, right? Because if you have read the major writing out of folks at Harvard, at Stanford, universities around the world, as well as what literally economists are kind of in the thick of the thing, who are looking at, you know, kind of where we're progressing, they will tell you this notion of preparing for the jobs of the future is the most backward thing you can say, right? That's speaking the language of 1957, okay? Because there was historically a theory that when an old industry died, a new industry filled its place, i.e., you know, you got rid of the buggy whip factory, right? And then you created the car factory.
I believe Ron Johnson didn't apply the term correctly, but you're talking about creative destruction.
Right. Well, this whole notion, exactly, that one thing goes down, something else comes up. Well, that's where they radically don't understand the automation revolution and the role that AI and other computer-related developments are going to play. They aren't working right if they create new jobs, right? The point of automation is not to, it should be in my mind, to free us from drudgery, to make our lives more wonderful. No, the point of automation in a capitalist and business context is to reduce the number of workers, because the investment in robots is incredibly expensive, right? You invest in these robots, and you don't say, oh, yeah, and then we're going to create all sorts of new industries, or we're going to create new jobs in this industry. No, it is that you have a lot less people working in traditional industries, whole big industries, and machines do a lot of the work. In fact, so the machines keep evolving and developing, so they do more and more of the work. This doesn't mean that there will be no employment in the future. That's not the case. But it does mean that it's a fantasy to think that everybody who's got a job now is suddenly going to have a job making robots or repairing robots or something like that.
Well, this is
the reality is we're going to have to think a lot societally about how you deal with fundamental changes at work.
You know, it's interesting that the conversation that's been going on for the last week. Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing, very thoughtful organization.
Smart guy.
Right, smart guy. He said they're all singing from the same hymn book. I said they're all singing from the same hymn book, and he said this has become a religion for them. And they it's a small group of people, but they have access to the media, and they repeat the same things over and over without doing any self-examination.
Oh, yeah. No, and I think Scott, who I know and who I have a great deal of respect for, is right. And he and I might actually even disagree on some of the long-term projections as regards where industry goes and what happens with them. But he understands the changes that are taking place. And let me give you an example of one thing that I don't think Donald Trump fully gets. Okay? If you start a trade war on steel and you bring steel production back to the United States, and they really do start the factories up and you know, start doing a lot more in them, you need to understand that's not going to bring back hundreds of thousands of jobs. Steel was traditionally a really rough, hot, intense way to make a living.
Yeah, I mean, Scott's not under any illusions on that at all.
No, I don't think he is. I'm not saying he is, but I think some people listen to him, some people listen to other folks, and they think, well, you know, we're talking about this. Scott is talking about smart 21st century manufacturing being ahead of it. I totally agree on that. I'm a big champion of Scott's. What I'm saying, though, is that this, when you don't bring a discussion about automation, AI, digital technologies into this, people can hear this and they can think, oh, yeah, we're going to get tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of jobs back. The reality in a lot of industries, not just steel, but in a lot of places, is if you really did start a trade war and you bring some of this work back here, you'll have an initial boost in jobs, which is great and important in a short term, perhaps. But ultimately, an awful lot of those factories are going to be highly automated, as will, frankly, this is the other interesting subtlety, as will new factories developed in other parts of the world. So the notion that this is a fight over jobs, it is that to some extent, but in an economy where we know where we're headed and we kind of know some of the things that are going to happen, it's less about jobs than it would have been 20 years ago or 50 years ago.
You know, it's interesting, though, they're all singing from their free trade Bibles. Even if you somehow agree with these horrible deals, you would, at a minimum, expect the people involved in those deals would be playing by the rules. But the truth is, they don't have any problem with China flooding the market with cheap steel because they just care about the commodity price.
Well, the terrible thing is this, right?
Am I wrong? Thing,
no, you're well. This is the awful thing. Somebody who hates the idea of a trade war, right? And trade wars can be bad. They can. A lot of negatives can come of them. But somebody who hates the idea of that in the current context, you have to ask them one question. Are you really worried for the workers you have never met? Or are you worried for the investors who you know very well?
We'll take a break there. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation at SlysOffice.com. Welcome back to SlysOffice.com. We're talking about what's transpired over the last week or so with potential tariffs. As we're recording this is Thursday morning. It looks like the president is going to at least temporarily not put tariffs against Mexico and Canada as they're renegotiating NAFTA. Gary Cohen, his economic advisor, has left this week, and I thought you'd enjoy this. This is Stephanie Ruhle from MSNBC. Listen to what she says here.
Sort of Wilbur Ross's coup d'etat on policy. Wilbur Ross and Peter Navarro, and remember, you've reported it, Wilbur Ross is a guy who has been falling asleep in meetings for months. Peter Navarro could not get a job inside Goldman Sachs in the mailroom. He's not a widely accepted economist. Wilbur Ross rocks up to the president. You want a war? Let's go for a trade war. How about China? And the issue isn't policy for Gary Cohn. It's process. So Gary's not surprised that President Trump has a nationalist agenda. He was elected on one. But Gary has repeatedly said America first doesn't have to be America alone. But the president led Wednesday night and Thursday with this cockamamie 10%, 25% tariff plan without coordinating with the State Department, the Defense Department, and the Treasury Department, and most importantly, White House legal counsel.
You know, it's funny. I'm sure that's all Stephanie Ruhle is concerned about is the process. why is it that we accept someone who came from Wall Street, who helped tank the economy in 2008 as an economist, and yet Wilbur Ross, who is hardly a perfect player, but let's face it, Wilbur Ross is one of the richest men in the United States, and he's taken over a fair amount of factories, worked with the unions, and kept jobs going. Why is that not credible? But somebody who, by the way, you know, Gary Cohen did work at U.S. Steel. If he'd stayed in that job right now, he'd be applauding the president.
Yeah, of course he would be. Well, you know, anybody, look, that's the funny thing about it, right? I can find you business folks who are saying they like this idea. Not all of them, and not maybe even folks who are on the inside, they may have some quibbles on some aspect of it. But here's the interesting thing. I don't want to be cynical with you, okay? Because I know you're like a kind of, what I love about you is your sweet, generous naivete. And, you know, I don't want to rain on your parade. But do you think there might even have been other reasons why Gary Cohen left?
I think there might have been.
Mueller's asking for all the records of everything. And, you know, you got like all this crazy stuff going on. My sense is, Gary Cohn, it's like the perfect reason to leave. Yeah. Boy, you know, I had to draw the line. I was willing to accept all the Charlottesville stuff. And, you know, it's firing the head of the FBI. I could live with that. I could live with all this. But, boy, a steel tariff, I'm out of here. So my sense is that people have to be a little less naive. They have to understand that, you know, there are people who are leaving.
But to
reasons.
My broader point, why is Gary Cohen considered an economist? Why do you have more credibility if you work at Goldman Sachs?
No, yeah, that's an absurdity, right? And, you know, it's not Goldman Sachs. It's Government Sachs, right? This is an entity that, you know, fills out government agencies. You know, they you know, kind of like send their executives into the federal government to do this, to do that, blah, blah, blah. And this is something you just have to understand about how Government Sachs works. It's private sector with a huge, overwhelming influence in the public sector. And Cohn coming in is, you know, significant, but you do know that there's a ton of other people with Goldman Sachs ties, peripheral and direct, who are in all sorts of other positions, not least the Secretary of the Treasury, right?
Steve Mnuchin.
And, yeah. And so the thing to understand here is
he's a real prize.
That he's a real peach. But the thing to understand here is that these people are not interested in, you know, smart economics or looking at the future of the economy, the future of work, things like that. These are people who are interested in making money and for making sure that they and people like them continue to make money. And what they know is that their ties to government help that to occur, right? And so, yes, they do preach a gospel of a certain kind of free trade that has been very beneficial to
them.
Them. Well, investors, right?
Right.
These people are investment bankers. They deal in, you know, the movement of capital. They don't deal in, you know, like making sure that Youngstown has a lot of jobs. And so, yeah, they disagree with any kind of intervention by Trump or by Sherrod Brown, by people on the left or the right, as regards these trade issues and some of these economic issues. They don't like a breaking of the consensus. Now, that's not to say Trump's doing it the right way. And it's not to say Trump is a good player. But it is to say that the notion that somebody like, and that's why I brought up the other side, the notion that somebody like Gary Cohn signs on with the Trump administration and somehow finds everything kind of acceptable until you get to this, no, that's... The reality is, I think Cohn's leaving in part because he doesn't feel he has sufficient control, right? Things that he doesn't like are happening. That's an understandable reason to leave. But we should understand that he's not leaving because he's got some genius understanding of the economy. It's because he doesn't think that his continued presence there is going to be beneficial to the people he seeks to benefit.
The mainstream media, the Lawrence O'Donnells of the world, the Stephanie Ruhles, Rachel stays away from this stuff. Chris Hayes, I don't know where he is. He used to be with us. He doesn't say much about it.
I think Chris Hayes and many other people understand these issues. I do think there are.
He's not vocalizing or verbalizing anything.
But one of the things I will say that's really important, well, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that don't bring this up. And this is even in the China Free Trade Fight, we could write books about how undercovered all these things were. But one of the things is, I really want to emphasize, one of the great accomplishments of the last 30 years is popular education as regards trade policy. And there's a tremendous number of Americans who really do understand a lot about trade policy. And the great frustration is that our media, all of our media, covers it in such immature and underdeveloped ways.
Absolutely. By the way, here is a professor. His name's Daniel Dresner. Listen to this.
So basically, these tariffs hurt ordinary working class Americans in two ways. The first is they're going to raise consumer prices. The price of every steel using industry is about to go up, which even people like Wilbur Ross and Peter Navarro acknowledge. They just sort of claim, well, it's just a small tax, just a couple $100 on a car, which I guarantee you is really important to a working class individual in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing, by the way, is, you know, to push back on Chris's point, the notion that this somehow just, you know, free trade just benefits effete intellectuals on the coast is absurd. The fact is the trade partnership, which has produced the first analysis of what these tariffs will do, suggests that it'll create, you know, a net loss of 150,000 jobs, primarily in the manufacturing industry. And last I checked, they're still using industries in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin as well. So the idea that this is somehow some kind of a net gain is absolutely absurd. It's dumbass economics.
There you go.
Well, there you go.
I didn't know he was concerned. He's never shown any interest in the loss of manufacturing jobs, ever.
Some people know a lot about dumbass economics. They're experts on it. Look, I can tell you this. I'm not an economist, Law. I was an editor of a newspaper in Toledo, Ohio. I saw tens of thousands of jobs go. I saw the direct connection between trade policies and the loss of those jobs. I also saw the direct connection between a lack of a national industrial policy and the failure of this country to even begin to think about how to replace those jobs. And so, with all due respect to an awful lot of people who comment on this stuff, the real world on the ground is this. People in Washington develop out trade policies and often implement them. They are cheered on by a lot of people in the media and by a lot of people in academia. And all I know from 30 years of doing this is that when I said in 1992 and 1993, A, NAFTA isn't going to work in the way they say it will for the U.S. or for Mexico, and B, that it is not going to turn out to be popular with people in this country or other countries, I was right. When I said in 2000, China free trade is not going to work out the way they say it is, and that it is not going to be popular with people on the ground in communities across this country because it's going to really have devastating effects on them. Everybody said, oh, no, that's not the case. It's going to be just great. I was right. And it isn't that I'm all that sharp. That's not the point. The point is I learned by talking to the real people who are experiencing the real pain. And they saw it coming. They knew what was going to happen. They were correct. And the ultimate impact of these trade policies on the United States is not the thing that a lot of people talk about up front. It's not just on manufacturing and jobs. It's also inequality slide. The manufacturing economy of this country built the middle class. And when you rip that apart, you have a massive extension of inequality, which is exactly what we have had over the last 30 years.
Let me ask you this question. By the way, here's Chuck Dodd talking about, Chuck's come around. Chuck, it's begun to dawn on Chuck that the politics of this may be pretty good for Trump. He finally came to that realization yesterday. But here's what he said earlier in the week with one of his insider gaggles on Meet the Press, The Daily Show.
By the way, about the only positive response I've heard to this came from like Sherrod Brown. right, a handful of sort of old school blue collar Democrats.
Right. That's right. I mean, and he's playing to that. He's playing to that.
You know,
I know they all laugh.
They're like laughing at Sherrod Brown. Pretty serious.
It's a funny thing. You and I may be the only show where when the name Sherrod Brown comes up, we don't laugh. We kind of pause because we know something really smart and important is going to be said.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There's nothing to laugh about with Sherrod Brown. He's a Russian scholar. I believe he's a Yale graduate. He has been one of the most internationally savvy people I know. I've known him for decades. There's nobody in the Senate. No one. He gets the nuances and the subtleties of trade, as well as Sherrod Brown. He could argue with any economist they want to put up, and he would win.
So the politics of this, Joe Manchin, Bob Casey, Sherrod Brown, and a few others, Marcy Kaptur, have all said, hey, look, they may not have agreed with everything the president has said or done on this issue, but they talk about the importance of tariffs. Bernie Sanders has been a little more reticent to, and I understand why people are careful because you never know what Trump's going to do. But he said, hey, look, I think we should get out of PNTR completely.
I saw that. I heard that last night. Yeah. I thought that was a very strong and to my mind, really interesting statement.
Well, the commentary guy for CBS actually put something funny together saying that, you know, maybe Donald Trump should hire Bernie Sanders to replace Gary Cohn in the White House. It wasn't really meant as a compliment, but it was funny because they played a bunch of clips of Bernie essentially saying some of the same things Trump does. Has the media forgotten what happened in the 2016 election?
That's the thing. I mean, you had these insurgents come from the left and from wherever Trump comes from, and I never quite know, who basically disrupted both major political parties, and a lot of it had to do with trade. Again, I think trade has become a placeholder issue for dramatically rising inequality and for a real sense of uncertainty, even in some cases hopelessness about the future. So it's not just trade itself. It's a lot of things that relate to it. But if you don't understand the trade debate, you don't understand the politics of America. And I'll tell you, I'll just make it very, very simple for you, Sly. In February of 2016, I wrote a cover story for The Nation, essentially titled President Trump, It Could Happen. I was at a point where many people still didn't think he could get the Republican nomination and where almost everybody was dismissing him as a potential presidential candidate. You know the reason I wrote that? I talked to people like Marcy Kaptur. And even in January and February of 2016, they were saying, be careful. Donald Trump is saying things that are going to resonate in states like, go back and read the piece. Not that I was that smart. It was the people I was talking to. They're saying it has real potential to resonate in Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia. What do those states have in common, Sly?
Manufacturing.
No, something else. Donald Trump won them all.
Oh, well, yeah, that's true. I guess I just took that at face value.
But those were all states.
No, I agree. And I think, I actually think Trump had kind of a twin effect. I think in some respects, there were a lot of people that couldn't get themselves to vote for him, but his position on trade was such a contrast, even though Hillary was mouthing some words, I think it kept some people home.
That's the thing. In fact, if you look at the reality, I think that Trump generated increased turnout among some, frankly, very nasty right-wingers, right? People who really have some attitudes and ideas that are profoundly unsettling for our country. But I don't think he generated a lot of turnout for him among traditional Democratic voters, right? So, you know, I think a lot of people misread, and they think, oh, well, Trump won Wisconsin. Trump won Michigan. That means a lot of people who voted for Obama must have switched over.
No, that was a pretty small group of people. Yeah, there were some. Right.
But here's the important thing about it. Here's the important thing about it. In Wisconsin and Michigan, take a look at Trump's total, well, in Wisconsin especially, you know, or any of these states. Take a look at Trump's total compared to Mitt Romney.
Right.
Right?
Pretty similar.
He didn't moon out the Republican vote. He didn't get a lot more votes. He kind of held or even was a little below in some cases. But the problem was a lot of people either voted for third-party candidates or didn't vote.
Yeah, the votes he lost in Brookfield and Mequon, he picked up in Brown County and out of Yamhee County. Yeah. And I have to play a little treat for you here as we wrap up. As you know, Beto O'Rourke is going to be challenging Ted Cruz in Texas. There's a lot of talk about Texas as a state right now and whether it's changing. And Ted Cruz launched a radio ad the other day, and it's actually a song. And I just think it's very important that you hear this Ted Cruz ad. It's absolutely remarkable here. Hang on a second here. Here we go.
If you're gonna run in Texas, you can't be a liberal man, 'cause liberal thought is not the spirit of a Lone Star man. You gotta be tough as Texas and honest about your plans. If you're gonna run in Texas, you can't be a liberal man.
his stories. Liberal Robert wanted to fit in, so he changed his name to Beto and hit it with a grin. Beto wants those open borders and he wants to take our guns. Not a chance on earth he'll get a vote from millions of Texans.
If you're gonna run in Texas, you can't be a liberal man.
I'm Ted Cruz, that and I approve this message.
That is a beautiful piece of music there. And you know what I love the best about it? They figured out how to rhyme gun and Texan. Did you listen?
Oh, yes, I did.
They got gun in there, and then the next line, they're like, you won't get a vote from a Texan.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, that's an interesting way to pronounce it.
Interesting, interesting that someone who uses a nickname attacking somebody else who uses a nickname.
Well, it's also interesting to me that if you watch the campaign that Beto O'Rourke has run, and I was down there in Texas last fall and actually saw a lot of what was going on down there. There's a reason why Ted Cruz is launching attacks immediately against him, right? It isn't because Ted Cruz wants to make fun of him, because Ted Cruz is just a mean guy, although that is probably for Ted Cruz a benefit. It is, they are scared, and they should be scared. This guy is running a smart campaign, and it is, he's incredibly energetic. He's spending a tremendous amount of time in small town, rural, small city Texas. And frankly, there's only one way to say it. He's trying to rebuild an old Democratic coalition of working class white folks, working class African Americans, working class Latinos. Reaching out to Latinos who are the rising voting bloc, or a rising voting bloc in that state. It's very interesting what he's trying to do. And it looks like he's going to have a ticket down there that's going to have women and people of color and, you know, a lot of new folks coming into politics. We've always said about Texas that at some point the demographics are going to change that state. They're going to make it, they're going to open that state up.
Yeah, whether it happens this time or next, he's hopefully building, and he's going to help some congressional candidates as well.
Well, that's running, it's happening, Sly. I don't know whether it's going to happen this time or next. You know, that's always it's always a great challenge. But the secret to that isn't just the demographic change. It's having candidates who can energize and excite all the new potential voters, right? And I'll just say that, to my mind, looking at it last fall, I think O'Rourke is actually doing that.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
You know, we work hard every day. In mills and mines, hospitals and schools, in office buildings, pharmacies and shipyards, factories and forests, in squad cars, ambulances and taxicabs. We do all kinds of jobs in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and all across the United States and Canada. We build the things that build our country. We do things that keep our country going, support our families and our communities. We have the courage to stand up even when no one else does. We have the strength to fight for what's right, for our families and for yours. We're your friends, your neighbors, your sisters and brothers. We're more than 1 million members strong. We stand in solidarity with workers in every continent on the globe. We're the United Steelworkers Union, and every day we fight for you. Please join our fight. Visit usw.org or like us at facebook.com/steelworkers.